listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest the next 2 hours is Michael Zalenti, and he is going to talk about something that should be important to every parent, and even if you're not a parent, I think that his views, Michael's views, are so important for everyone, and this is a very hot topic, a very important topic. So welcome to the program, Michael. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on. That was a great introduction. I hope I hold up my end now.
Oh, I'm sure you will. It's you mentioned that about kindergarten being the first major experience. And I never went to kindergarten. My birthday fell in the wrong month, so I actually didn't start school until I was 6 and a half. But when I went to school, we learned about reading, and we learned academic kinds of things. We weren't indoctrinated politically, which is something that is it is being done more now than anybody can imagine, unless you have a child in school, unless you're an astute parent who is actually paying attention to what your child is being taught. This makes me very upset.
It is very difficult to monitor this kind of thing unless you really do have the time and energy to be your child's advocate in school. So it's sort of same as having an ill relative in the hospital. You know, you don't just leave them there and hope for the best. You visit, you see what's going on, how are the nurses treating the patient, are the doctors coming in. Well, you know, the idea that you would just drop your child off at a school and sort of hope for the best is it just doesn't work. And you know, when we talk about indoctrination, in my view, there's really two elements here. I mean, one is official indoctrination, right? If you've got a textbook that says something that the parent thinks is incorrect or age inappropriate or whatever, that's one thing. But if you have a teacher, classroom attendant, whatever, you know, whoever the person is, who has a strongly held point of view, often that'll seep into what they're talking about, how they're conducting the class. So the textbook may be just fine. But if you have a teacher who has a distinctly liberal point of view, that's likely to come through. And in my experience, I come from a highly democratic and liberal family. I'm one of the few conservatives in the group. And what I find, with all due respect to my family members, is that liberals tend to be more sure of themselves and more willing to believe that they are right enough that instructing others in their views is perfectly fine. I think conservatives tend to be a little more circumspect and willing to acknowledge that other people might be right sometimes.
Correct. Now you have a book, and I love the title.
Okay.
It's Dr. Deplorable's Political Characters A to Z. And the other thing, and of course I have mentioned on this program before, that I do not believe in prayer at school because, okay, who's going to lead the prayer? What are their beliefs? Children go to school to learn academic subjects, not political or religious views. So I'm very much against, a lot of things that so-called conservatives, seem to embrace, which, and so I really appreciate your views on this, but what are they learning in school that is so terrible? They are being taught not only, they're not only being politicized, but their culture is also being altered. When you hear about children, young children, being taught, being told that they can choose their sex, and all the other things that are really just unbelievable. And as you said, a lot of parents simply drop their children off at school and hope for the best. But I think that times, of course, have changed. And parents did used to, they used to be room mothers. I was a room mother and I attended PTA. But now a lot of mothers are working. They're working full time. They don't take the time, have the time to really look at what is going on in school. And the other thing is that I just feel I have questions about is that there's so many sports activities where the children are encouraged to engage in sports. Now, when I was in school, we had our sports activities at home. We'd get home from school, do our homework, go play basketball. But now it's organized sports. And who's it organized by and what are they doing? It's time away from family. And I think that children are not learning family values, but they're learning things that aren't so valuable from sources that they are not monitoring.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way. I think, unfortunately, it's because schools are each unique. It is very, very hard to draw any conclusions. Right? You back in the day, I think my father, I laugh about this only because, my dad was very strong on having my siblings and I go to Catholic school, and it became ultimately unaffordable because there were seven kids and my dad drove a forklift. So only two of us finished Catholic school. But my father, I think, had realistic expectations about what would and wouldn't be taught in Catholic school. And in eighth grade, I had a lay teacher who posed to us an assignment, which was write a book. Now, I was very, this is now my first self-published book. I never published anything back then, but I wrote a book. And most kids in classes, you can imagine, maybe 25 kids in the class, 22 of them handed in three pages, and it was like pulling teeth to get them to do that much. And then three of us just thought this was a wonderful assignment. We were going to write a book. And one of my friends had older sisters who were hippies, and his book talked about drugs. I mean, it was a psychedelic book from an eighth grader. I forget what the second person did. I did what I thought a novel was. I had no clue what a novel was, but I'd heard of them. And I had seen a couple of movies that were not aimed at little kids. And most of the ones I remembered were James Bond movies. And so I thought, okay, a novel must be sort of like a James Bond book. And I had, my hero was an eighth grader, and the Russians were taking over the school, and he was, it was actually very righteous, except, of course, he swore a bit, there was one mention of his girlfriend's sweater, and a few things like that, and I got an A, not surprisingly, because I did 25 pages, and I worked really hard on it. And my father got to see it at some point and was so upset because why was a Catholic school giving me an A when I was writing swear words? You just don't know what it's going to be. And I do think, a big part of the key is involvement if you can. It's just every school is different. And every teacher is different. And there's no, it's not like saying, give me the Cadillac XTS and we'll all be alike. You just don't know what's going to happen. And unless you're homeschooling, you have to guess at it, and you have to spend as much time as you possibly can talking to your children about it and getting a sense of it. And what my book is about is beating, I'm not, so pro-conservative, anti-liberal, I don't want it to come off quite like this, but beating the liberals to the punch. Okay, you know your kids are going to hear things, see things on TV, hear things from friends, schools, whatever, and you know that there's a pretty good chance that the most of what they're going to experience is going to be things that don't, certainly don't match your beliefs. They may be diametrically opposed, or maybe they're just off a little bit. And what I found with my children, I really, really expected that they would be very politically astute because I was a political junkie from the outset. I like to say, because it's true, that my favorite television show growing up was the Watergate hearings.
That's great.
Sat at home and watched those things. I could, you know, I can't do impersonations, but if I could, I could do Senator Sam and Howard Baker and Lowell Weicker. I mean, I just love that. And so I thought, well, you know, we'll wind up talking about these things and that's how they'll pick it up. And the political questions just didn't come up. I had a brief conversation with my son one night. I forget how it came up. And I was proud of him because when I said that the British redcoats marched in single file and the American patriots hid behind trees and rocks and threw things at them, my son's response was, well, redcoats are stupid. Yeah, okay, that's good. That was a pretty decent reaction. But we didn't talk politics pretty much at all. And when they didn't join my wife and I watching, you know, whatever, I don't think Fox News was even around when they were first growing up. But when we were watching news programs, they weren't interested. They were off doing other things. And I was big on not pushing them into stuff. I figured it'd happen in time. And then one day I found that they had politics and their politics weren't mine. And it wasn't just a question of saying, oh no, that's really wrong. Let me just show you what it is. You try telling that to a 16-year-old kid, you're not going to get very far. My mom used to say to my brother and I, you know, if I haven't instilled morality in you by the time you're, you know, 6 or 7 years old, it isn't going to happen. And very wise comment. So anyway, so the book was intended, is intended to be something that gets read aloud to kids. You know, went back and forth. I had what I thought of as a very sophisticated book, and I showed off all the things I knew. And then my wife at one point said, that's not a kid's book. And so I started running the text through readability analysis on the internet and, you know, kind of thought through it again and scrubbed some of the verses and came up with different things. It's still not perfectly a kid's book. I mean, it's pretty hard to talk about gerrymandering, to a 5-year-old. It's just not going to happen. But I did try to make it interesting enough and certainly fun enough. And I worked with a wonderful guy, named Kyle Fleming, who did the illustration.
Right. Which are really great.
Aren't they? Yeah. No, Kyle and I get along incredibly well. It was really a cool thing to sort of run into him. And I've gotten questioned on radio programs. The hardest question I have to answer is one you haven't asked yet, which is, what age is this suitable for? And the answer is, geez, well, I'd read it to a 5-year-old, but then when they get tired of it, I'd put it away and I'd pull it out when they're 7 and try, you know, because there are just things in here that, it hits at a bunch of different levels. And I think simply reading it, if you have, an inquisitive child who asks you 2 questions, on, you know, the 26 different letters and you talk about those, that alone, I think, makes it, for my money, it would be worthwhile to have that happen, to begin political conversations, and then see where they take you, because children are willing to learn and want to learn from their parents. But you don't, if you're like me, I'm a libertarian at heart. I don't know if I'm a libertarian in political circles, but at heart, I don't think I should be telling other people what to do, what to think. And I wanted my children not to have me saying, here's how to live your life. It was like, let's see what you want to do and let me help you do it and let me help you be happy. And obviously if you take a terribly wrong turn, let me pull you back. But, they're living very cool lives. I mean, they're in their late 20s and they're doing neat stuff and it's fun to watch them.
Indeed. It is really, as you say, the book is wonderful and we can go through it and okay, Brenda, Howie, Kim, and Angela.
I have no idea who they are. That's Kyle.
That's Kyle. And you said to my mom and dad for instilling in me the love of books. To Maureen for her incredible generosity and encouragement.
Maureen is my wife. Mom and dad are who they are.
Right.
They're the ones that got, you know, just, I'm not sure how I was so in love with books, but they had to have been the ones doing it. No one else was around to do it. I love them. I had a hard time, scaling back my collection as we moved from big house to smaller places.
I don't think I could move from my house. I look at all the books. I have two wall-to-wall bookshelves that are just immense. I don't know how I would part with them because each one means something to me. How do you, it's like choosing children or something. It wouldn't be good. But, my father, my mother said, oh, your father always has his nose in a book. And so he was an example to me that there must be something in books that is very worthwhile. And I think that you could learn anything in the world from books, even things like cake decorating and things that you would think would need to have some sort of demonstration, or you would have to have some practical experience. But I learned how to do cake decorating by reading a book and looking at the illustrations and then practicing. So I credit books, all my books, with everything that I am or could be or would be or should be. I love books. I love books. It's
great, and you know, and the people in your audience who love them too, just they know where you're coming from. It may be hard to spell out exactly, but it's they're wonderful. It was tough. I mean, I partly what I did is we have a small vacation house that used to be far away when we lived in New Jersey, and now is further away, living outside of D.C. But I put a bunch up there for storage. But part of it was the realization that I got after a while, and I started thinking, well, my kids want these things. My dad, who passed away quite some time ago, grew up in the Depression, right? So he saved stuff. He saved nails and straightened them out and used them again. And, you know, we had a garage full of stuff that to most people looked like junk. And, my older brother Steve and I took just diametrically different, had different ways of dealing with my father. Steve one time said, yeah, what's all this junk? What do you got here? And my dad said, you know, well, I'm saving that for you. And I'm sort of this fearful kid, and I'm gonna say, okay, Dad, that's great. And say, I don't want this crap. So yeah, it just sort of depends. But I knew for most people, well, it depends. I mean, I understand that you do a lot of research, so it's probably different because you want to hang on to things that you've researched to make look again. But for a lot of books, you know, I question myself, so why is that on the shelf? What is that doing? And mostly it's a marker, right? It's a little historical tag to show you where you've been. And which is great. I mean, but I realized there were an awful lot of books that may have served that purpose, but I knew to a certainty that I would never look inside them again. And I knew, having seen what happens, at garage sales, I knew that, you know, if I went before everyone else, they'd be sitting out there in a box, you know, a buck for 50 of them or whatever. So I figured let me call them down a little bit so it'll look like maybe these are the important ones. But it is tough. It's a little like giving away kids.
Right. Well, my grandfather was the pulp king of America during the 30s. His name was Arthur J. Burks, B-U-R-K-S, and he was an author, and he wrote a lot of books, and so I think it's a genetic thing with me also that I love books because I have a family history of books and people who love books, and they instill that in me. among other things that weren't so great. Anyway, we do have a quick break. We'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. To change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, welcome back. I love that song. I always hate to break in when it's playing. My guest for this part of the program is Michael Zielinski. He is the author of Dr. Deplorables, Political Characters A to Z. I love that title. And the website is drdeplorable.com. All right. Let's pick up where we left off. I was talking about books and how important they are, but I hope my children feel the same way, because they're going to have, well, quite a few of them. I think they know that. So, you are concerned, of course, about being indoctrinated, and they begin so early. When children aren't thinking about political issues or sexual issues or any of these other things, and I kind of wonder, and you kind of implied it, that I'm not so certain that children should be starting school that early. And you mentioned homeschooling. What is your views on homeschooling?
Well, if you take a look at the letter C in the book, C is for competition, and mm-hmm. what the end line on the book is. I'm sorry. Let me treat it that. I'm quite terrible at this, so I may ask you to do a few of mine.
So sure.
I'll try it. In my head, I know what it sounds like. C is competition, the use of brain muscle to win market share in a free and fair tussle. Support the homeschoolers and charter school movements. Choice among schools will bring outcome improvements. And then you see a spinning wheel.
Right. like Wheel of Fortune.
Wheel of Fortune, but standing upright. It says, choose your school, and a mom and son are looking as the wheel is spinning. And there are many choices, public, home, private, military, boarding. I threw in clown just to round it out. But
sure.
Yeah, there are lots of choices. And I was lucky enough to study economics at the University of Chicago at right around the time when the other big schools were recognizing that the Chicago school folks, Milton Friedman and his colleagues, had been right. And they did, interestingly enough, they did exactly what's happening now with the whole Russiagate thing. Right? You would think that after years and years of chanting this nonsense that was untrue, you would think that there would be a little tiny period of apologizing or just saying, gee, we were wrong, before moving to the next thing. But I found out back when I was in college that it just doesn't happen that way. Print people, and this is quite literally true. I mean, it sounds a little ridiculous as I hear myself about to say it. People at schools like Princeton and Harvard and Yale literally laughed out loud at Chicago school stuff. It was like Chicago school was idiotic and it didn't make any sense. And then one day, it just, I don't know if it hit them or the evidence was overpowering, but one day they just switched. And it was radio silence on we were wrong for the last 20 years or we mocked you for the last 20 years. It was just, here's what it is now. And so it was a very cool time to be there because we were winning, right? And we had been the underdogs. And I was so terrible. I could have taken a class with Milton Friedman and I didn't, because he taught a heavily econometric class, meaning lots and lots of statistics. And I was mm-hmm. not a math whiz. And I just, instead of saying glasses half full, I'll take a class from Milton Friedman, I said, oh my God, what if I got a C or failed the class from Milton Friedman? I can't have that happen. So I didn't, but I met him on a number of occasions. He and his wife Rose, another economist, would come by our dorm house for sherry hours, and they'd sit and talk to the students. And luckily for me, we played Monopoly a lot, and my board was the one in use, so I did get to keep it. I have a board that is signed "Down with Monopoly" by Milton Friedman.
Oh my gosh! Cool. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, very cool. So back then, you know, the discussion about charter schools was really just in the incipient stages, and it really, you know, to this day, it's moved a fair amount. But what I think has actually happened, the anti-charter school folks, which is basically the teachers union folks, have an incredibly smart strategy, and I've got to hand it to them on the strategy. They are turning this into a one school at a time battle, right? So that every charter school is kind of going through a gauntlet and battling to get there, or anybody wants to put in charter schools, it's really tough. And what's never happened is no one has said, no politician has been smart enough to say and push through something where you would.
Oh, we do have a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back. Welcome back. Our guest is Michael Zelenty. That's Zelenty. He is the author of Dr. Deplorable's Political Characters A to Z. It is available at Amazon, and the website is drdeplorable.com. And
Deanna, I pushed you through the break, which means either of two things took place. Either what I was saying was totally mesmerizing you, or I put you to sleep.
No, it's mesmerizing. it's good. Sometimes that happens because what the guest is saying is you just don't want to interrupt. And so we just, it's just... just how it is.
There you go.
Yeah. There's a lot, and you were talking about charter schools, and I'm just kind of up in the air about charter schools. And, of course, the Chicago, I live in the suburbs, but there is so much politicizing of the school board and this recent election for the mayor. Oh my gosh, what a mess that was. And you had people who were really, really, part of the political machine, which has been going on for forever. You have, the Dailies who have run Chicago for such a long time. And then you had their political machine, which is still in place. And so,
have you been there for decades and decades, or have you,
since 85. So, but I live in the suburbs, but I do keep attuned to what is going on, and oh my gosh.
I was there during the winter that elected Jane Byrne.
Oh, now she was a very interesting person.
Yeah, this was, when the tracks, well, Chicago had a terrible winter, and Mike Bolandic was the guy who, took over for the first Mayor Daley, the real machine politician, and he put in place a 10-year plan to be ready for the next ginormous winter. Only it came in the first year of the 10-year plan and nothing had been done. And so the tracks were freezing all over the place on the CTA. And as you know, as a suburban person, the trains all run from the wealthier suburbs and then go through the poorer neighborhoods and then get to downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And what the CTA was doing, presumably with Bolandic's knowledge and blessing, is they were picking up people at the beginning of their route, people who could probably afford to take a day off or had cars that they could drive into work, and they'd fill the trains to capacity, close the doors, and then ride through the poorer neighborhoods where people often didn't have cars and couldn't afford to take a day off from work, and drop the wealthier people off downtown. And Bolandic got on TV every night like Baghdad Bob and said, everything is fine. And you could have run, you or I could have run, anyone could have run against Bolandic that year and won, but Jane Byrne was the one. So that elected Jane Byrne. Bolandic was hopeless in that race because of the terrible window.
And she actually spent time in the neighborhoods that you refer to. Mm-hmm. And certainly those neighborhoods have been targeted for drugs and all kinds of things. Chicago politics is just really dirty. It's pretty filthy.
That's another whole show or two for you.
For sure. But anyway, let's get back to your book. And B, you talk about B is for boondoggle, wastefully spending the taxes we pay for their schemes, never ending. Don't trust their budgets or cronies. We warn you, those high-speed train dreams may derail California. And so, which is what we were just talking about. And I often listen to AM 560, and I think sometimes that, well, okay, for instance, you have people who do not have children in school, who have not had children in school for decades, and yet they pay incredibly high taxes, property taxes, for educational purposes, which I think is not fair. I think that the parents should pay for their children's education. I'm not sure how that would be structured, but Sean Thompson, who's on 560, AM 560, talks quite a lot about this. And I kind of go along with him that, because these high taxes sometimes, cause such a hardship on older people that they lose their homes.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things that, and I'm sure, that particular, radio host has talked about it at least on this issue, one of the more remarkable things is that the school budgets in every place I've ever are voted on in an election that's separate from the general election.
Right.
You have all these people coming out and are able to vote on everything under the sun except for the school, because, and you know, I think everybody who follows politics knows this, is when the school budget comes up, there are teachers, parents of school-age children, and old people. And those are who come out to vote.
Right.
You know, but it's just, you know, it's sort of a rigged system. And, you know, I would have thought, I tend to have, you know, I look at myself as having terrific ideas and great insights, but I'm usually about 25 years too soon. You know, so it's like, oh yeah, this market is going to crash. Let me get out of it. Well, it lasts another 25 years, but I was right. I just didn't make any money. With the school stuff, I thought for sure that, that our American system of education was going to get overhauled much more. I mean, it really hasn't happened yet, but basically I thought it would happen much quicker than it has, if only because so much else hinges on it. I mean, crime hinges off education, just incredibly. When I think about what we learned about applying economic principles to different situations, it is so easy to look at crime and say, well, why are some people willing to commit crimes and others are not? And the answer in most cases is very sensible. It's not as though people who commit crimes are not being rational. If I go out now, I've been a lawyer for 35 years and sort of semi-retired, but still practicing. If I go out and commit a crime and get caught and go to jail, I will lose my ability to earn a living. I will lose my reputation in the community. There are a lot of things that I stand to lose. If some young kid who doesn't have good job prospects commits a crime, and doesn't face a whole lot, of things that he considers very negative, as the consequences, Well, he's being much more, you know, he's being rational and saying, okay, committing crime is not that big a deal. It's a big deal for me. And that's in part because I have this stockpile of education that is useful to me. I'm not about to abandon.
Of course. And a lot of children, people growing up in certain areas of Chicago feel hopeless. They don't have the choices. And the other thing too, which is another problem altogether, but you have the pensions and you have the salaries. Some of the professors at some of the colleges, not just in the Chicago area, universities, are $200,000. And they spend limited time in the classroom, and their pensions are incredible. It used to be that teachers were not paid very well, and it used to be kind of a profession that women went into, and kind of like secretaries. You always figured, okay, a secretary is going to be a woman, and it's going to be they're going to be earning a secondary job along with their husband. But now you have this huge pension issue here in the Chicago area that is creating such an economic situation for the whole state. People are leaving the state in droves because of the bills, the indebtedness that the state is incurring by allowing these huge pensions, which are, it's incredible. More people would leave Illinois if they didn't have family or didn't have obligations here because of the economic situation.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the things that will probably wind up getting New Jersey straightened out, my home state, original home state, is its size, right? It is incredibly easy to leave New Jersey because wherever you want to go is not far from where you are now. If someone is still of Illinois, to leave Illinois a lot of times requires a lot of mileage. And California is the same way. I mean, both of our children live, one is San Francisco area, one is LA. And, you know, my wife and I would love to be out there with them, but we're not going to be the last person holding the bag on the taxes, in California. So, you know, we'll do something else. But yeah, no, it is pretty remarkable. Illinois is a sad, sad case. I have, like probably a million other people, there are teachers in my, family. And, you know, I will say just check where you are. My older brother, taught high school for years and still, teaches at tutoring, and he's in Florida, and he said, no, I double, triple checked. Florida's actually really got a good, strong, economy for the pensions. I said, okay, just keep an eye on it because, for me, it's an IRA and whatever Social Security does, and I'm not banking on Social Security to do much.
Right.
You have to kind of, you know, play this like, You have to be smart and recognize that anything can happen, and sometimes things don't happen for a long time and then tumble, so.
Right. Who knew that we should all invest in Uber, right?
That is true. That is true.
So anyway, yes, it is really wasteful spending. So, maybe the new mayor elect, I guess she'll be being sworn in the next few days, we'll do something about this. But it's much easier it's not very easy to backtrack and take away things that people are used to having.
Oh, sure. No,
it's just not possible to do. And this, the corruption in the city government in Chicago has been going on for decades. So it's not bound to change anytime soon. And of course we also have the crime rate, the guns, and well, you can't buy a gun in Chicago, But you have to go out to the suburbs to buy a gun and ammunition. But there seem to be plenty of guns to go around. And of course, anytime that you have crime, then you're going to have more control. And what they've done is they've taken away a lot, they've decreased the number of policemen in Chicago. And the others they've kind of militarized. So it just doesn't seem equitable to, it's very unfair that they're decreasing services that everybody needs in order to pay these pensions that people expect and they've paid into. And then you have the CAFR, which is another story altogether. But anyway, let's forge ahead in your book. And certainly the things you said about California. Who would want to go to California? I grew up in California. But would I want to return? Nope. Not at all. Despite the great weather.
Right. So where would you like to pick up?
Okay, we did competition, which I love that wheel. And, I love the illustrations. It does make for something that you could share with an astute child.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that was definitely the point. And basically I hired Kyle, using Upworks. And, as he put, it's sort of like Uber, you leave a review of your driver leaves a review of you. Kyle had about three lines. I mean, I get along with him, but he had three lines. One of them was, Mike knows what he wants. Which I took as sort of a backhanded compliment.
It is, absolutely.
I knew what I wanted for the book, and so a lot of the illustrations were things where I would say, I wanted to look like this or to have these things in it. Maybe a third of them started where he would say, here's my, actually more than a third, I shouldn't care. Maybe half of them were things where he'd start with something and say, what about this? And I'd say yes, but tweak it this way or that way. And there was a lot of just back and forth. So in one case, I wound up changing my verse to match what happened. Let me talk about that one now, because you might enjoy that as a radio person. If you go to L, L is for Limbaugh, talk radio hero. L is for Limbaugh, talk radio hero. Executes flawlessly, mistakes close to zero. Talent on loan from God, so to be fair, he lets half his brain nap while he's on the air. He's got the picture of Rush at the golden EIB microphone, and he's got a half a brain, which is drawn like a very cartoonish half a brain, because you don't want to be gross about it, sitting in a little easy chair on his desk with a tiny table next to him with a book and a cup of tea. Now, what happened on this was I didn't use the brain napping. I used Rush's own words, right? So it was talent on loan from God, something, something with an A-C-K ending, and he has half his brain tied behind his back, right? So I used almost entirely his fun little quotes that sillier people take seriously, where he's just, being funny.
Right.
And Kyle, after a number of tries, came back to me and said, I cannot figure out a way to have half his brain popping out of his head and tied to the back of his chair without this just being grotesque. It just doesn't work. I've sketched. I can't do it. And I forget which of us came up with that.
I think that illustration is great for L. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. This is Deanna, and we are talking with Michael Zalenti, and his website is drdeplorable.com. He is the author of Dr. Deplorable's Political Characters A to Z. Now, I, believe it or not, when I thought I was conservative a long time ago, although I don't, anyway, there are people who really buy into this arrogant arrogant person. Rush Limbaugh and his brother David is pretty similar. Talk radio hero. Oh gosh, talent on loan from God. And I love the illustration that you've come up with. It's perfect. The brain sitting there in the east chair. That's a perfect illustration.
That's great. Thank you. Appreciate that. Now you must, if you like that, you must like K Street on the flip side of that page.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it.
It is one of my very, very favorites.
Exactly. And you have these, and this is really something that people, children, because children have a sense of morality that, they would see the unfairness of what K Street and congressmen and what they're doing. You have people who tell you all these good intentions. They lie to the public and tell you what they're going to do when they get there. But when they get to Washington, all that goes by the wayside. And they serve term after term, and they make dough, which is what you said. And they don't have to follow the laws or accept what the general citizen has to do. They have their own Social Security program. Well, they don't even call it Social Security. They get paid for the rest of their lives. They don't have to accept the healthcare situation that Americans are roped into. They have special. They treat themselves as very special, privileged people.
They do. The insider trading laws are the things that drive me absolutely crazy. The idea that since so much of the value of various companies depends on what the government's going to do for them or against them, the idea that congresspeople and their staffers can trade with what is effectively some of the most remarkably solid inside information available is just mind-blowing to me. I mean, I was a securities lawyer for a lot of years. And the one thing you knew was the thing you couldn't do and the worst thing to do was trade on insider information. And these people have just said, go ahead, fine, make whatever. And so many of them go in, to Congress with not necessarily a lot of money, but whatever they go in with, they come out with way, way more than could possibly happen from their salaries. And it's disgusting to me. I mean, I think why I chose to write a children's book.
We're at the top of the hour. Okay, we'll be right back and we'll get back to K Street.
Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
All right, welcome back. Our guest is Michael Zalenti, the author of Dr. Deplorable's Political Characters A to Z. The website is drdeplorable.com, and we're talking about his book, and it's very well done. The images are great. You say a lot very concisely. Really, it's very concise.
I really like that. Thank you.
And so children well, everybody would benefit by reading this book. It's very short. It's you can go through it and
26 verses, 4 lines each.
Right. And when you flesh it out with a conversation, this is, I think what this is a way of expanding on what you've written as appropriate to whoever you're talking to or whoever is reading it. It's a place to begin to have a longer conversation about each thing.
That's certainly the intent. I'm glad it comes off that way.
Right.
So what, can I set the stage with a description of the K thing?
Oh, please, yes.
So you're looking at a red velvet bench in a fancy bar, at least I think so, fancy Washington restaurant, and you see two people who, if you don't know better, you just assume they're politicians, and if you're a political junkie, you know that this is John Boehner and Paul Ryan sitting there. When Kyle first did the illustration, he had Boehner with a bottle and no glass. I said, you can't make him out to be drinking straight from the bottle. Give him a shot glass at least. And Kyle did, I mean, I chose who to put there. Kyle made the bottle in very, very thin print. You can see instead of it being Johnny Walker, it says Wrongy Talker. And there's a footnote, and the footnote is the footnote mark, like where the number one or two would be, is a Milton Friedman head. And at the bottom, there's a larger Milton Friedman head with a quote by Professor Friedman from an article, an interview with him in Reason Magazine. So I will turn it over to Deanna to read.
Okay, it says, one of the worst features of our system.
Sorry. Start at the poem first. At the top.
Oh, okay. K is for K Street, where congressmen go. When term time is done and it's time to make dough. Oh, I love that. Just love this. And in chats with old colleagues, they use all their clout to put loopholes in and to take loopholes out. So these are the same people who plan an invasion or allow an invasion of another country. And before they do that, they invest their money in ammunition and companies that make ammunition and bombs. And so then they decide to have a war.
It's that and a million other things.
Right.
Everything that they do has an effect on marketplaces, and I assume that the worst of them are just working that angle for all they can. And Friedman always he had one of the things that he wrote about that I always thought was very interesting was he said that while basically he is an anti-tax person or lower tax person, he said what you don't want to be doing is changing the tax code all the time, even if you're making it better, because each time you make a change, people need to adjust and it slows down the economy. And what he would prefer is if a president came in and in the first year said, we're going to do one tax change and that's it. And then we're going to sit tight for 2 years and we'll do another one. So get it all done now. And the quote is, one of the worst features of our system is that you have a new tax law every year or every 2 years. Why do you keep changing it? Because that's the most effective way to raise campaign funds. Lobbyists will pay you to put loopholes in. They will pay you to take them out. And I just thought, first of all, that's brilliant. Second of all, it sounds so much like Dr. Seuss to put loopholes in and take loopholes out. I couldn't resist that part of it.
Indeed. I want to backtrack for just a moment. When we were talking about school choices and everything back in the C letter, when you had the federal government come in and take over the Department of Education or create the Department of Education was when things really began to go south or become bad for your local schools, because then they can use federal money to change politics and to offer, well, bribes to school districts, in order to get them to, for instance, decide that there are a certain number of handicapped children in a particular class.
Right.
And the more children you have who are handicapped, the more money they get. So that brings in a whole other issue altogether.
Yeah, the whole scamming the system issue, which is
right.
Yeah, it's other people's money. I love when you hear, and I ran for a Board of Ed slot in Plainfield, New Jersey, way back. Came within 15 votes of unhorsing the president, but as my wife said, you're lucky you didn't win. You know it's 3 years, don't you? I said, no! It's always been near and dear to my heart, but I am always flabbergasted when you'd hear people say, you know, let's spend money on this or that. It's federal money, or it's state money, as if that's not
all. Right.
Somebody else's free money. Who's federal? Who are these people? I believe
right.
That's access to the feds and the state. But they would just look at it as, you know, you wouldn't waste the local money. And maybe you would, but you wouldn't be as willing to waste local money. But boy, when it seemed to be coming from another source, you'd throw it at anything. It's just awful.
Right.
You know, I read something. This is pretty esoteric, but when else am I going to talk about this esoteric topic? I wish I could remember the name of the individual or pair of authors who wrote this book. But it was a study of schools and why they work and don't work. And the basic upshot, I mean, if you read the whole thing and you had to do one sentence out of it, the upshot would be that if you have a consistent, very good manager type, if you have somebody running it, who runs it the same way consistently and makes sure it happens, you'll tend to have a good school. And if you have chaos in how things are run, you won't. And so private schools tend to have, you know, one administrator or one principal or whatever, and that person stays in that position and has a fair amount of authority. Public schools, you know, things can switch every couple of years, 3 years, whatever. And all of that is pretty sensible, and I wouldn't have found it remarkable, but for this one add-on, what they said was they found that it was worse than ever in the public schools because some group would get in and say, well, we think we should run the schools this way. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but well, we should run it this way. And they would pass laws to do that. And they were afraid that they would not be in power in 3 years or 6 years. So they would decide how to run it, and they would not just say, hey, principal, this is what we want you to do, but they would pass regulations to make sure that if they were ever voted out, it would still be run. And then eventually they get voted out, and somebody else comes in. Well, they've got these regs on the book. They decide we should change it and do it differently, and they would pile on another set of regs. So what you wound up with is instead of a nice kind of clean, here's what to do, you'd have all these regs that were running opposite one another. And so you'd wind up with this screw and stalemate that could never be run right. And it was a function of voting in public schools. It was not like somebody wasn't saying, oh, public school teachers are bad teachers. It was just the whole way it's set up is structured to failure. And I read that, you know, you get one of those things where you read something and you say, that's an insight I just hadn't thought about. But now that it's pointed out to me, duh, you know, you smack yourself on the forehead and go, oh my God, of course that's what's going on.
Right.
So yeah, it's just, it will change, whether it's in my or your lifetime, Deanna, I don't know, but it has to change.
Right. Let me share a comment from the chat room. Teachers are no longer the good guys, folks. They are the willing, albeit most often unwitting, tools of organized crime. Public servants should be required to wear ankle bracelets and be placed under round-the-clock surveillance. I thought that was pretty funny.
Although, let me give your listener his or her tip. I do think it's not unreasonable. I think it'll never happen, but it's not unreasonable to have cameras in the classrooms with with public service. Just, you know, I should be able to watch what's going on in those classrooms. There should be nothing that's happening that's not available to the public. I mean, it'll never happen, and people will make a big fuss about the privacy issues. But the real issue is just like open, not open secrets law, but sunshine laws and things like that, right? Where you're supposed to be able to, government is doing. This is your government, but it's a pipe dream. But I certainly think that teachers would be more circumspect about, you know, just throwing their own opinions at kids or, you know, as opposed to teaching the subject at hand. But on the other hand, I'm sure that if my siblings who are or were teachers ever hear this broadcast, they'll be beating me about the head. So maybe I should just step out of this one for now.
Well, I think that you have a good point. Because in this area, I'm not sure about other areas, but we do have teachers who have become physically violent with children and have treated children abhorrently. Children go to school, they put their trust in their teacher. At least it used to be that students really trusted their teacher and felt protected at school. And now you have teachers who actually hit children, attack children. So I think probably cameras might be a good idea. Of course, you also have a lot of children who have cell phones who take photos,
That is changing it, yeah.
Yeah. So it has certainly changed, definitely. Do you want to backtrack and go back to, I love that the image of the K Street. Paul Ryan, that the face couldn't be better. oh gosh, I love that. Just love that.
Do Deep State?
Let's do Deep State.
I couldn't put you on the spot, but do you recognize the players in the Russian nesting dolls by any chance? It's not an easy one. I mean, it's just a couple of lines.
The one at the top looks like Dennis Hastert? No?
Nope. It is, it's supposed to be James Comey at the top.
Oh, okay.
Then Mr. Strzok and Ms. Page at the bottom.
Oh, okay.
If you compare these to the pictures, you'll see it, but it's obviously not. I mean, you know, this is one of those, I think the youngins call them Easter eggs, you know, one of these things where it's...
Right.
But somebody, yesterday or today, somebody pointed out to me, see what you're doing there with the Russian dolls. And I thought, you know, I was thinking nesting dolls, but I wasn't actually thinking of the connection with the country Russia. So that was, you know, that was an unintended joke there.
But it works.
And the picture is, for those of you following along at home, the picture is of a large platter on which is a turkey cut in the middle, inside of which is a ham cut in the middle, inside of which is a nesting doll, with Comey at the top, and then as though two dolls have been taken off, and that's Strzok and Page. And it reads, D is for deep state, obscure, dark, and murky, like nesting dolls baked inside ham, inside turkey. Each president's wishes they're sworn to enforce, yet Washington pros fight to steer their own course, which is obviously what they've been doing for a good 2 years and change. Hopefully we'll see some roundups going on, some people taking out in handcuffs, one would hope.
Well, they have so many lobbyists who approach them, and yet when constituents actually write letters, which I used to do, gosh, I wrote all these letters, and I would just get a form letter back. And they essentially told me, we really don't care what you think, we're going to do it this way. Right. They didn't say that, but essentially that was the message that I received.
People writing.
Because I'm not a lobbyist. I don't have any money to throw in their deep pockets.
One of my younger sisters, it's a large family, one of my younger sisters did get a non-form letter back, when she wrote to the IRS. She was a language stickler, And somewhere in the 1040 instructions, it talked about we have a voluntary tax system. and which is sort of true.
Anyway, volunteer. See what happens.
She wrote to the IRS and said, so does that mean I don't have to pay you? And she got a letter back that was, it didn't look like a form. It looked like, hey, you better pay.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it was a great letter to own.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Volunteer. Huh. And of course that was supposed to be, just like Social Security. A lot of these things that are put in place, we're told this is just temporary. It's like the toll roads
in Chicago. Yeah.
We're just going to do this to build the road. And then people forget that it was just to be temporary and they just accept it. I think that the public has a very short attention span and they forget what they have read. They forget what has happened. And then they just go on from there. They don't remember that something has been announced on TV, on television. And they just go from day to day and whatever the programming is for the day, then that's what they accept. It's kind of a sad situation.
Yeah, I'm going to take slight issue. I'm going to give a little more credit to those people. I think you'll see a change coming out of the use of the internet.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Because if you look at something and see you have an issue, and then you look at whatever you want to call them, mainstream media, but whatever
mm-hmm.
term of endearment you'd like to use for them, you look in the media and you don't see it talked about. And you're not in touch with a zillion other people. So, I think that you only have so much time in the day and there's nobody saying put your signature on this or march for that or whatever. And so it goes away. And so the media has controlled an awful lot of the dialogue. The internet has made it easier, not perfect, but easier for people to stay on an issue, right? Join, whether they're joining a group or whatever. People can't make the issue disappear. The issue might shrink, but if you decide that you want to set up a website or what have you, to kind of round up people who are interested in that issue and keep them informed, it is better in that sense, right? I mean,
right.
We had nowhere. I mean, God only knows what this conversation that we're having would have been two people at best. I mean, if you'd ever found out about my book, this would have been two people in a living room.
Right, on the front porch somewhere.
There's nothing wrong with that conversation, but it's not reaching a wider group of people because there just wasn't the means to do it. So I'm a little more optimistic, although I try to remember that these things take way more time than I expected.
Sure, and I should have made that an exception to what I said. I was referring mainly to the mainstream media.
Oh, yeah.
Thank goodness for the internet. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, and you may not have written this book.
Yeah, I know. I think that that's right. Well, I mean, for one thing, I did self-publish.
We're going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the facts
for good, to live in harmony. Starts with you and me. All righty, let's get back to our guest. Michael Zalenti is the author of Dr. Deplorable's Political Characters A to Z. His website is drdeplorable.com. Shall we do entitlements?
Sure. Let me just say, I'm not sure that this needs to be said, but doctor is spelled out in the website. So if you put in Dr. Deplorable, you'll get somebody else.
I didn't make that distinction. Okay.
No. I mean, there's no reason, but it occurs to me that somebody might assume it's the same. But if you put in Dr. Deplorable. If you go on the web and look up Dr. Deplorable, you'll find me.
Right. And I posted it in the chat room too. So.
Even better. Thank you. So here, let's do entitlements. I'll read this one. E's for entitlements, things that are due to you, like hospitals, college, and a trip to the zoo too. So where do the docs, profs, and animals come from? You've got me with that, Sean. It's quite a conundrum. And the illustration shows hospital, shows a college, a professor, a doctor, and a giraffe, looming large over them. And the idea, pretty simply was, this was a hard topic for me to figure out. Kids, think entitlements are great. And kids and liberals, right? I mean, AOC being perfect case in point, you know, we should have free college. We should have, here are all these things that are good things and everyone should have them and wouldn't it be a wonderful world? And let's make sure everybody gets them. And I think that that's probably, I don't want to say pernicious, although I love the word, but it's a pernicious way to get kids involved in politics because you say, aren't these good things? Shouldn't everybody have them? Yes, yes, yes. And then the next leap is, and government should provide them. And it's hard to say no to that if one thinks of government correctly is way bigger than the rest of us. And you're a little kid, you go, oh yeah, I guess we should get that. So in order to at least get children thinking about the issues with that, you could say, well, we need a budget and you'll lose them. But I was saying, well, you know, you're saying that these things are due to you, but how do you get the doctors? How do you get the professors? Where are these animals coming from? How do you get these free things? And get the children to think about, get whoever's reading this to think about how somebody's got to be paid for or coerced into doing this. You know, it's a nice to say there's a free college. Why don't you be the professor? Why don't you be the doctor if everyone should have free health care and provide it for us? And, of course, I think in a conversation with a kid, you can at least get across the notion that, well, that's not fair. I should get paid while I'm the doctor. Okay, well, then, you know, just – again, with a lot of these things, in my perfect nirvana, I think that something comes up a little later in your kid's life. You know, they're in third grade and some teacher says, you know, we should have free system for X. And the kid might remember back, well, where are you going to get that from? And it just enough to say, hey, I don't think this person knows the whole story is a huge success in my book because I think, as you said, kids trust their teachers. And they don't just trust them to not hurt them or hit them. They trust them when they say something that, well, they're the teacher. They're supposed to be in front of me telling me what's true. And why on earth would I think that this statement is any less perfectly true than every other statement?
It might be a good idea if you're trying to teach a child this particular concept would have them be the taxpayer, give them $5 with a lot of change, and then say, okay, if we're going to have a free hospital, or if you believe that everyone should be able to have free medical care, you're the taxpayer, so you will have to give me, or give the government, or whomever the entity, this money. So if they have a practical experience of where that money is coming from, they might think twice. But certainly, everybody wants free things. Everybody wants instant gratification. That's why Amazon is so popular. People want, they want something when they want it. And this all started several decades ago with credit cards.
Right.
It used to be you saved your money and then you purchased something. And then they came out with these credit cards. I'm not sure what one was, American Express maybe, or, and then, oh, you could spend money. You could spend money that you didn't have and you didn't think about the interest. You didn't think about that. But before, you thought about it, you actually saved for something, you put money aside. But credit cards really, really changed the economy a great deal, changed culture a great deal. Wouldn't you agree?
I think that's right. And I like the $5 thing. I'd love to speak it a little bit if you said, okay.
Okay, let's talk about this on the other side of the break.
Okay.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony.
It starts with you and me. All right, we are back with our guest, Michael Salenti, the author of Dr. Deplorables, Political Characters A to Z, and the website is Dr., spelled out, drdeplorable.com. Okay, so we're talking about giving a child $5 and acting as a taxpayer.
Right, and you were suggesting basically taking that away for the free thing, and I think if you said, okay, you know, free health, what would you like to the government to give away for free? Well, free health care. Okay, well, that's $1.50. Okay. Free education. That's another dollar. And just basically wind up with, you know, would you like some roads with that? Would you like police to guard you? And just go through the things, basically not to say you can't have those things, but to say there's a limited amount of money. Oh, and by the way, do you want some change back for yourself so you can buy some things you'd like? And just get across the idea that, as they famously said in Chicago, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
Tonstoffel is the acronym for that. We had a snack bar in our dorm called Tonstoffel just because we thought that was cute.
Indeed. No problems
here.
Alrighty. Yes, children need practical experience, which I don't, even though my home life was not so great, they did give me an allowance. I did have to do chores,
mm-hmm.
and I got an allowance, and, it teaches you, to take care of money when you're young. But now, it seems that the children are just lavished with all of these things. There's so many things that children can have. Technological toys and cell phones and, my goodness, 5-year-olds with a cell phone? Please. It's just gone overboard. I'm not sure whether it's parents who feel guilty for not spending sufficient time with their children or what is going on.
I don't know.
Or parents who aren't parenting?
I do think some of it is having seen some nieces and nephews and grandnieces, et cetera, the iPhone or the smartphone is an incredibly easy babysitter. I mean, my parents, you could accuse them of sticking me in front of the TV sometimes, although
mm-hmm.
we certainly were able to just go out and play too. It's an easy babysitter, and the world is such that people have decided that having your kids just go outside and run around, because there was a whole community of mostly stay-at-home moms or whatever, but there was a community, right? You knew that your kid
mm-hmm.
Would be on the street and would usually stay out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Parents have decided, perhaps rightly, I assume that they're being sensible, that they can't trust that to happen properly. And so their kids are indoors, and, my God, I don't know what my mom would have done if we were all under feet all the time, but if she had a video game on a phone that she could have handed to one of us to get us to be quiet. She might, as good a mom as she was, she might have succumbed as well.
Sure. Well, when we had, my husband and I, my first husband and I had children, we had a television, and then we decided one day, let's get rid of the television. The children are just spending too much time in front of the television, And the programming had changed gradually, incrementally it had changed to the point that I didn't appreciate what the children were watching, mm-hmm. even the programs designed for children.
Right.
So we got rid of the television. Oh my gosh, did life change for me. Because I did have these children. I only had two, but they were right there. And so we went to the library all the time. They played outside. And of course I was in California, so you could play outside a lot of the time. But my children could ride their bike around the block. Dad didn't want them to. I had a 2-year-old that decided that she was going to take a little day trip around the block. It's a very long block. And of course that didn't work. I was, oh my goodness. But you're right. The culture has changed. Society has changed. And it's not as safe as it used to be. Gosh, when I was a child, we would go outside after breakfast, and we'd come back at when it got dark. And my parents never said, oh, where did you go? Because we were all over the neighborhood. We'd go 2 or 3 miles away and go to the park way up the street. And because it was safe, it was okay.
Right. Yeah, no, and you know, it's hard to know if it's really much less safe. But again, it's the kind of thing where, I forget the exact, there's a great word for this, but it's escaping me, but the idea that you are bound up with the society you're part of, and you really can't avoid it. So, while you may decide, you know, this is safe, or this would be safe if the other 50 sets of parents on my block also thought it was safe.
Right.
All the kids were out there, but you can't force it on anybody else. And maybe it's not so safe if your kid is the only one riding around the block. And,
right.
And it's a strange thing. My son did some professional acting, did commercials and some other stuff when he was younger. And my wife would take him, you know, if he got a call from, or she got a call from the agent, she'd, you know, had a deal worked out with school. She'd pick him up, you know, as soon as it was over, or maybe one class early, and drive him right from New Jersey right into the city. And after a while, he got to know it pretty well. And she was not a stage mom. I would have been upstairs in the offices trying to get myself to be a star. But luckily for Alex, she wasn't like that. And so he went up by himself after a little while and got used to the whole thing. And other parents, you know, the children who were in high school would say something, you know, I'm going to go into the city. And you'd hear these stories secondhand. It's like, no way, you're not going in. Who are you going with? Alex. Oh, okay. Alex Valentino. He knows the city.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
You know, I mean, it was great that he did, but it was also, it just was a sign of the times. And, you know, it so much just depends on how you view it. I'm going to tell you a story that's completely off the beaten path, but it does talk about people's different attitudes about the city. I grew up in a little town called Dunellen. It's a square mile, and it was about an hour, maybe a touch more by train from New York City. And we lived right basically next to the train station. So I used to love going in there and hanging out and doing stuff. But I knew most of my classmates really did not. I mean, they viewed it as it was New York. New York was not someplace you went to. And after, a while after I graduated college, I came home and I went to the local saloon, which was famously known as the college, because it was where people went after high school if they didn't go to an actual college. And I stopped in there and it's actually after law school as well. And some friends, so, you know, how you doing? Z was a normal nickname for Zalendi. And so, hey, Z, how you doing? Good, good. Yeah, you're a big fancy lawyer now. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And one of my old friends said, you know, went into the city the other day. Really? You did? Yeah, yeah, yeah. We went in to see 42nd Street. And I immediately thought, oh, he's not talking the musical. you know, they must have gone in to see what there was to see on the old fashioned 42nd Street before it got Disneyfied. And he said, yeah, yeah, we drove into the city and we got there and couldn't find it, pulled over, said, you know, looking for 42nd Street. And he goes, oh no, you're in Staten Island. And he's chosen.
Oh.
Now of course, the reason they were in Staten Island was because when the drinking ages were different in New York and New Jersey, New Jerseyans, the closest place to go to buy beer was Staten Island. So that's why they went to Staten, and they were looking for 42nd Street because they were in New York. So it tells them where to go, and they drive some more, and said, yeah, and then we kept driving, we got to this place and said, you know, this, I don't see it here, where's it? Pull over, oh, you're in Brooklyn.
Oh my goodness.
So then they, yeah, they go, okay, and they keep driving, and they said, we wound up on this place, called Bleecker Street. And, we went and, you know, stopped and had a drink at a bar and we got the hell out of there.
Yeah.
So this was this person, and I love this guy, so, you know, not to knock him, but this was his experience going to New York as an adult. So, you know, everybody has different experiences and you can't, unfortunately, you know, you can't sort of decide. There are very few places where you can decide, I'm going to go live there because all the people are like me and they'll all feel the same way about how to raise their kids. So you just, you know, you have to live with where we're at now. I feel lucky. I got to ride my Schwinn Stingray with the banana seat all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and in fact, when my brother and I first got the Schwinn Stingrays, it was a big deal for our parents to get us those. And we went right out and I had the brilliant idea that we should play Demolition Derby because I'd seen it on TV. And I didn't know that the cars were just for Demolition Derby. They looked just like my old man's car. And so we did. We got a bunch of other kids to agree. And the kids with the 26-inch bicycles that didn't have a good turning radius like we did,
mm-hmm.
he got his bike completely smashed. And his parents came to our house.
Whoops.
Right. But no, we were like, but, you know, it's Demolition Derby. It's a game. We played it. He lost. Look at our Stingrays. They're fine.
Wow.
I don't think we were able to sit for quite some time after that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. But yeah, bringing up kids is the most interesting thing you can do, but it's certainly tricky.
Absolutely. But it's a wonderful experience and it's great. How about let's go to Friday.
Okay.
F is for Friday, the day to dump news. Oh yeah. Oh, this is so true. Shall I continue? Yeah. F is for Friday, the day to dump news in. To tamp down concern among those who are snoozing when forced to disclose to us something alarming. That is so true. Big news stories, Friday is the best time or right before the holiday.
Right.
Do something New Year's Eve or Christmas Eve. Nobody's going to listen.
Yep.
Or hear. They're too busy.
When forced to disclose to us something alarming, they put it out end of day Friday. How charming.
Yes. Oh, I have to scoot up. Yes, absolutely. Oh, isn't that? That is cute. They put it out end of day Friday. How charming. Wonderful book. Wonderful, wonderful.
Thank you. I enjoyed it a lot. I started in October of last year. And, oh, I know what I was talking about, self-publishing.
Right.
I think that this book is good enough to go to a traditional publisher, but I learned so much in doing this. And one of the things I learned is, why is it that there aren't books like this? So, like, why could I go into downtown Madison, New Jersey and find a feminist bookstore, for instance, which exists and didn't help me shopping for my kids when they were young. But there's no equivalent. I mean, there used to be, there was something called Laissez-Faire Books, a libertarian bookstore in Manhattan. It was the only one I've ever heard of, and even it shut down, even though it's got, you know, a crime place in Manhattan. And I realized, once I started to see who the editors were, and also who the agents were, there is a type, and I mean no disrespect to anybody, but you could, if you said, pick me an editor or pick me an agent who is accepting submissions from a new author, it'll be a young woman who is from a liberal arts college, good one,
mm-hmm.
who almost certainly majored in English or one of the languages or something like that. I mean, you're no economics majors or anything like that, which, again, makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
And who, when asked, you know, what books are you looking for, I want something that will thrill me. I want something I can champion. I want something I can really get behind. Now, there are plenty of other things. You know, I want other stories. I want LGBT, whatever. But put that aside. There is a desire, it makes perfect sense to me, a desire for people to say, I got into publishing. It doesn't make a lot of money, right? It's a grind for a lot of years. It may never make me a lot of money, but I'm in it for the love of literature, the love of books, and I want a book. I want something that I'm going to really, really love. Now, people who have that track record, I mean, if you took that same demographic and said, how many of you voted for Trump versus how many of you voted for Hillary Clinton? I'm going to tell you, it's probably about an 80, 85, 90% Hillary Clinton group. And I'm not sure that they would have hated this book. They might have thought, for what it is, it's not bad. But there's somebody in that group is saying, oh, this is a book I want to champion. It's just not.
I don't think so.
And so I wound up, at first I thought, well, this is my failure. I couldn't find a traditional publisher. And I thought, no, it's not a failure. It's the market. It would have been really tough. I mean, there are people in publishing who publish religious books, right? If this book had a Christian flavor to it, I could have gotten published as a Christian book. If this was a tome talking about the educational system, I probably could have, you know, gotten it published by Basic Books or Regnery or, you know, but a joking around, lighthearted, fun book for kids that has a non-left wing or anti-left wing slant to it, there's nothing out there. I mean, there's virtually nothing out there. And so I look at this now as, you know, I'm not on a mission from God or whatever. I'd like to break even. That'd be sweet. You know, I hired an illustrator. Kyle got paid by me. A website person got paid by, you know, I took the family, savings, and that's why Maureen got thanked for her generosity, because she's a woman who is, you know, is willing to say to me, yeah, it's something you really want to do. Let's go. And it's out there, and we'll see what happens. And if I can make a run of it, there'll be more Dr. Deplorable books. I'm working on something now that's aimed more directly at kids. It's called From Crybaby to Capitalist. And it will follow, how we all start as crybabies and then consumers and competitors, and ultimately, if we hit the big top, we'll be investing our earnings in other people's businesses to help them along. So we'll see. There are lots of pipe dreams out there for this. Cause I did enjoy making the book and working on it. So why not?
Well, I think my personal opinion is that if you know something that would, oh goodness, we have a break. We will be right back shortly. All right, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Michael Salenti, the author of Dr. Deplorable's Political Characters A to Z. The website is Dr. spelled out, drdeplorable.com. What I was going to say is that when you have something that you feel very passionately about, I think that you have kind of a moral obligation to share it. And you're not doing it to make money. You're doing it because you feel morally obligated to share this information. And I don't think that the publishing industry is necessarily out to completely share the truth, but to program children. I think what you've done is remarkable. I hope you break even, but I have a feeling that even if you didn't, you'd be okay with that because you've created this wonderful product.
No, it's been very nice. It's nice talking to people. You know, it's clearly, I would say it's not for everybody by a long shot. But the people who like it seem to really, really like it. And that's just meant an awful lot to me. It's not my eighth grade book with the swear words, but it'll do.
Well, I love it.
Thank you. Can I read one last one? I know we're—
Please!
Well, this is my favorite illustration. And if you get the book and like it and you're so inclined, you can actually get this illustration with the words in a poster form. because it's just too good. I'll read it and then tell your listeners what they'll see. T is for talking points, whispered in warning to like-minded journos and pals every morning. Coordinate, sync up like Bob Fosse dancers. Whatever their questions, just stick to these answers.
Wow.
And this is all about the talking points that go out, literally go out every morning to these people, so they're all, you know, you'll notice that they're all saying the same things. And it shows, basically a scene from Chorus Line. So you have, Rockette-style, kickers in spangled outfits. And going from left to right, you have Chuck Schumer. You have, Rachel Maddow for a second, I space.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yes, Anderson Cooper, Nancy Pelosi, and of course Joe and Mika, because you couldn't have talking points without Joe and Mika. And it was really funny. Kyle's politics are at least as far to the right as mine are. And I actually had him scale back some of this. I asked him at one point if he could kind of soften Nancy Pelosi's face.
No, I think it's good.
So proud of this, and he's, you know, like, he was, no, don't make me change it. So I was, okay, no, this is fine. But the first one that he did was Anderson Cooper, and you're looking at the book, Andy. I mean, just,
yes, perfect.
Brilliant. Like I said, so we did this as an 11 by 17 poster, which I love, but it's just, I don't know, it's fun. There are some very, very cool, pictures in here. We did get the pictures and the words to mesh up quite nicely, and it is readable to kids, but boy, there are a lot of adults that I'm finding who just are enjoying the heck out of it. I think if you're in any environment where you have to be a little quiet about your political beliefs or worth offending people, get this book, keep it at home. I send it in more or less a plain white envelope, although it does have a Dr. Deplorable sticker in the corner, which is an eagle with a stethoscope. You know, you don't have to worry about the mailman giving you hard times.
Well, it's wonderful. It rhymes. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
And it's not just for children, for goodness sake, but it's very applicable for children as well as adults. It's a fabulous book. And thank you so much for sharing it.
Well, thank you.
And
at first I thought, how are we going to do 2 hours? And then I thought, no, 2 hours are up already. So
I know.
It was very comfortable talking to you. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much. It was wonderful having you on as a guest. We'll have to do this again and see how this is going over.
That'd be great.
Okay. Thank you so much. Take care.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you next week. And have a great Mother's Day.